For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. With me is someone I love discussing stories with, Caitlin. How are you doing, Caitlin?
I am wonderful. How about you, Mark?
I would say wonderful, if anything, is an understatement. We are going to be talking about video games today, as we always do. We're going to be talking about what we've been playing lately. We're going to be talking about retro games and our gaming opinions on old school funware, aka Goof, where we're going to be talking about Bushido Blade. We're also, whether Caitlin likes it or not, going to be talking briefly about ancient philosophy. We're then going to go on to our feature game, which is Transistor, which is almost retro, but not quite. It's one of those cuspy things.
Mm.
And then we're going to shout out some upcoming titles in our shameless hyping of upcoming titles. So with all that in mind, Caitlin, what have you been playing lately?
I started and finished Final Fantasy III this last week for my Final Fantasy quote-unquote book club. I'm doing air quotes. I've brought it up in the past, but the gist is that we're playing every mainline Final Fantasy game starting from one, and this is the third installment and the one that, or one of the ones that didn't originally come out in North America. There was a Nintendo DS release in 2006, apparently, which I bought and never played, but I played on the Pixel Remaster this time around.
And you finished it all in 1 week.
Yeah, so we originally had scheduled the discussion for the same day as the Super Bowl. And then one person was like, oh, I actually watch football. Can we not talk about it that day? And it was like, okay, sure. So we delayed it. And then I started playing on the Wednesday before we were supposed to talk about it. So I had to go pretty hard. That said,
wow,
the old Final Fantasies are all pretty short. I think I finished this one in 10 or 11 hours. So it wasn't too bad.
On the topic of going hard, I don't watch football, but I do have a strong interest in Drake being publicly insulted, and so I did care very much about this Super Bowl. So tell us about Final Fantasy III. I know literally nothing about it. I know a small amount about some other Final Fantasies. Like, I'd already known that Final Fantasy II was the one with the weird experience system.
Yes.
I know that Final Fantasy VI is the one with the clown. I know that Final Fantasy V is the one with the jobs. Tell us about Final Fantasy III.
So Final Fantasy III also has the jobs.
Oh!
So it's the first Final Fantasy game that has a class system. So everybody starts out as an Onion Knight. And then as you save the various crystals, as you progress through the story, you unlock more and more classes. I feel like it's implemented with mixed success, because some of the classes are good and some of the classes are useless.
That's not great.
So, I mean, some of them are useful-ish, or like at least they're gimmicky, like Thief can unlock doors, so you don't need to use an item that you bought in a store to unlock a door. Because apparently you just have to buy a key. You can just walk into a store, buy a key, and unlock any door in the world with it. It's great.
That's how keys work, yeah.
Yeah, but thieves can just unlock doors using their thievy powers. So there's also this one class called Dark Knight, which can equip dark blades. And it means that there's a certain category of enemy that when you hit it with a non-dark blade, it will divide, and then you have two of them. And it's super annoying. Like, my least favorite dungeon in all of Final Fantasy III was the one where every single enemy in it could divide if they weren't hit by a dark blade. I was being lazy about it. I didn't want to have a bunch of dark knights. So it was a really rough dungeon for me. Anyway, a lot of them are pretty gimmicky. There's one, I think, called Scholar that you unlock. And they're like, yeah, the scholar can find out what an enemy's weakness is and tell you how many hit points it has left. And that's like all it can do. It's like, why why would I? So I unlocked it and I was like, oh, okay. You know, they're kind of hinting that the next boss I might want to do that with, you know, find out what it's weak against. And then I got some white magic, like level 4 white magic that could do exactly the same thing. And I was like, why? Why does this class exist?
I feel like a lot of my life choices are being subtly questioned here, but that's legit.
So it was Final Fantasy III is a little weird because in some ways it feels like a step back and in others like a step forward. So Final Fantasy II was the first Final Fantasy game that actually had a named cast of main characters that seemed to have like, you know, some semblance of a personality. And then Final Fantasy III, I start up the game and it shows me 4 identical characters, only differentiated by their sprite color. And it's like, here, pick names. I'm like, oh, okay, that's what this is going to be.
I see where we're going with this, yeah.
Yes. But story-wise, it seemed like they kind of, you know, it's really been interesting to see how the story or their attempts at writing like a good game story have changed from 1 to 2 and now 2 to 3. I had a lot of fun with it. Definitely liked it more than Final Fantasy 2. One of the things that I've found coolest about it is getting to see so many of the origins of stuff from Final Fantasy 14 that I first first encountered in 14. So like the main first raid for Final Fantasy 14 is at the Crystal Tower, and the Crystal Tower is like the final area in Final Fantasy 3. And there's just lots of little things like that that I just think are super cool. And it's really nice to see their origins.
When does Cid first show up?
I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty sure Cid was in Final Fantasy 2. I can't remember if he was in 1. He was definitely in 3. In 3, he was a little bit funny. Like, he has, like, this big beard and a big hat. And he, you know, you can borrow his airship, which you promptly blow up. he equips, like, a battering ram to it. And he's like, go ahead. Go, you know, ram that big boulder that's keeping you from leaving this area. And you do it, and the ship blows up. Then he builds you another ship, but he can't remember how to make airships land on land, so it can only land in the water. Like, I don't know. He's a character.
I never really understood how the kind of idiom of references in Final Fantasy worked, right? Because Final Fantasy has always had this idea that all of its stories should be sui generis, that they're not going to have any continuation of characters. But at the same time, they're going to have a whole bunch of touchstones, sometimes consistently, and then but more often inconsistently. What I mean by this is there are going to be these cactus monsters, and they're going to look more or less the same, generally speaking. And this is true regardless of what graphics engine is being used to render them. But then there's going to be some character named Cid. And yeah, some of these Cids have had things in common. Like, they've all been dudes. So has there ever been a lady Cid, for example?
I believe that Final Fantasy 16, well, they had both. And then 15, I think, had girl Cid.
I think they've literally had nothing in common other than the fact that they've been called Cid. And this is what passes for, like, canon in Final Fantasy? I'm not dissing it. It's an interesting approach to, I don't even want to use the word continuity, because I think that's giving it too much. I remember when Final Fantasy, like, X2 or Final Fantasy 13-2 came out, I'm like, whoa, this is not something you normally do, Final Fantasy. What about these ones made you so interested in going back to the well? Because it's bizarre. The only other, I guess, possible exception is the fact that they kind of, sort of, decided to have the weird bunny ear people and Ivalice done again in both 11 and Tactics A2, but that's a separate thing and more to do with character designers than anything else.
Yeah, it's weird. Like, I mean you can like you said, you can always expect certain things to be the same. There's others where the concept of that character will almost certainly be there, and the name may be the same, but nothing else about them will be the same. Like, for the most part, most Cids, not all Cids as far as I know, but most are airship related. And maybe it is all Cids. I'm trying to remember if there's a Cid that doesn't deal with your airship.
Oh, okay. I thought there were more non-airship Cids.
My memory hasn't been like, Caitlin, you know, stupid person, why can't you remember? So anyway, everyone I can think of, at least. I can't recall for Final Fantasy IV, but
Caitlin, in your defense, you have 16 Final Fantasies rattling around in your head. And as we've just established, they're all really different, yet in some unspecified way, all basically the same.
Yeah.
And so it gets very difficult to differentiate them at some point. I'm amazed at the people who can keep the ones, the numberings from 1 through 9 straight. But then again, I haven't played a lot of them, so I'm not really in a position to comment.
Yeah.
So next up is Final Fantasy IV.
Yes.
Oh, Final Fantasy IV is the one that was released in North America as 2, correct?
Yes, correct.
Oh, okay. So presumably you have played that one before.
I have, yeah. That one I only played through once. I played through Final Fantasy III US/6 multiple times. So I'm really excited for that one. But 4 I remember being really good. So hopefully my childhood memory doesn't fail me.
And Final Fantasy III was the last Final Fantasy originally released on the NES, correct?
Yes, yeah. Final Fantasy IV was SNES.
With luck, they will continue on their upward trajectory.
Yes, I hope so. What have you been up to lately, Mark?
Well, I got a very welcome notification out of the blue telling me that a game on Early Access that I'd been looking forward to was now a real game and thus worthy of purchase. This is to say Whisker Squadron Survivor entered 1.0. And so I promptly purchased it because I very much enjoy roguelite structure. And I've been feeling like I wanted to fly around in a spaceship and go pew pew. And I gotta say, I have mixed feelings. I've been enjoying it, but I have some misgivings. For one thing, they're really leaning into the anthropomorphic cats gimmick. So I had thought that it was mostly just a visual touchstone and the fact that the carrier is called the Whisker.
Uh-huh.
And Whisker Squadron. So the curses that the pilots deploy are very cat-themed. So they talk about clump. Clump is the euphemism for excrement.
Oh my god.
And so they, as an insult, they call things clumplickers or like what, like, oh, clumps, like whatever. It's strangely, it's a weird combination of like Saturday morning cartoon euphemism,
yeah,
and really gross scatology. Because if I don't think about the association, it's like, oh, they don't want to say a bad word. Okay, fine. But if I ever consider the association for literally half a second, I get deeply grossed out.
Mm.
Because let's acknowledge, I don't have any particular hang about these things. But I mean, it's cat litter for crying out loud. It's gross.
Yeah.
Everyone knows this. Spray is also one of the... Anyway, so... It is more cat-like than I had anticipated, for
yes,
one thing. Another thing is that the recent upgrade is very controversial. Like, if you see on the Steam page, for example, you'll see that it went from very positive historically to recent reviews being mostly positive, which is a big step down. And a lot of people really don't like what they did in version 1.0. I'm not in a position to comment, because I've only played 1.0. Apparently, in earlier versions, it was more about dodging fire as opposed to blocking enemy fire. Now, mm-hmm, when you do a barrel roll, you literally just block all enemy fire. Not entirely unlike Star Fox, which is obviously the sort of inspiration for the gameplay elements as well as the graphical presentation. I did think it's a little bit weird in that I wish there was a little bit more emphasis on maneuverability. Like, there are some sections where you're trying to fly around through obstacles at the same time as shooting down enemies.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, you don't really have those interweaved with each other, largely because your weapon systems are relatively crude and you just fire straight ahead anyway. So you can't really have particularly dynamic combat set pieces. So the upgrades are pretty okay with one glaring exception. Like, it is impossible for any game to be compared to Hades and come out looking good. But again, I emphasize that when playing roguelites, I very much like it when the upgrades feel and look awesome,
mm-hmm,
and let you do cool things. You know, Risk of Rain did this extremely well. It is also the case that Dead Cells did this pretty well also. Like, you got to experiment with interesting and cool stuff. Whisker Squadron Survivor is all right, but it's not quite as bad as, oh, your critical hit rate has gone from 2% to 4% or any kind of nonsense like that. But it's not nearly as satisfying as all your attacks now call down chain lightning or something of that nature.
Yeah.
There's one huge exception, though, and that is when you start a run, your primary weapon is very, very anemic. Let me give an example of the starting default weapon, which is your laser blaster. It does 4 points of damage. This is hardly any damage at all, and you need to shoot a lot at a given enemy to take them down.
Okay.
The first upgrade that you apply to your laser blaster will raise the damage from 4 to 6. This is a 50% increase. This is huge. And so if that is in your initial slate of upgrades when you level up, you are going to take that thing. Now, it is the most effective thing. It's also really boring. It is arguably the most boring of any possible upgrade because you are literally doing the same thing you were before, just now vastly better. More efficiently.
Yeah.
And so that dynamic is very much to the game's detriment. I think Whisker Squadron Survivor could have had a different way of managing the primary weapon and or have the secondary weapons be more interesting, because the secondary weapons are also pretty boring in that it's just a straightforward, you use a missile and then you need to collect a missile to replenish that missile. So there's no cooldown or recharge or anything of that nature. So you don't get to, you know, play around with secondary weapons. There's an enforced scarcity. And so I think they could have opened things up a little bit with that. Who knows? The overall variety is pretty good. And so I've been enjoying flying around, shooting things. And sometimes you do get some cool upgrades. Like, I remember one build, I was flying around and there were 6 drones following me, 2 missile drones and 4 laser drones. That felt awesome. That was really cool. And you are getting the standard meta progression stuff that you like. You're unlocking new default weapons. There's not a whole lot, though. You get to unlock new ships. There's not a whole lot, though. And so I'm kind of a little bit disappointed. I mean, I think that it could have been left a little bit longer to cook in early access, so that there were a few more broader upgrades. Like, maybe don't have a major mechanical change just as you're entering version 1.0. I mean, that kind of makes me wonder, cynically, what early access is for, other than just getting money for your beta test. If you're just going to be rolling out major changes as you go to retail release. But we are not cynical here on the show, Caitlin. We would never be so cruel or so uncharitable as to think that early access is some sort of cynical marketing ploy. No, no, no.
Yeah.
Also, crowdfunding is all about individual initiative.
That's funny, because this is the second game in recent history that I can think of right off the top of my head that had a major change for the 1.0 release, and it that was not received well. And it's like, why?
Yeah.
Oh, that's rough. It was a Satisfactory-like game. It was some kind of factory game. It's like subterraneous something. Like, you're underground.
Sure.
And it, apparently it used to be one really big open world. And then they made it so that there's like distinct stages. And that didn't go over well.
Yeah, so I've been enjoying Whisker Squadron Survivor. I don't know how much longevity it's going to have. Because, again, not a huge variety of weapons or pilots or upgrades or ships. But the core flying around and shooting things is more or less what I wanted and more or less what I'm getting. One final complaint, though, and this is just more broadly a general problem. This happens all the time. And that is, I'm always a little bit disappointed when I get a new indie game that is relatively low in terms of graphical fidelity, but is very, very high in terms of system resources. And this is in part because I've got a variety of portable computers, and I'd like to be able to lower the TDP so as to get better battery life, and I don't expect my graphics card to squeal when it's not actually pushing all those polygons. I realize that it's difficult for small studios to optimize games. It's not so much about, you know, the quality of your coders or the quality of your game design. It's more about the ability to optimize the underlying systems. And so 2 games that look the same could be vastly, vastly different in terms of overall system drain. But Whisker Squadron Survivor is more system demanding than I would have liked. Overall, I'm a little bit disappointed by Whisker Squadron Survivor, but I'm still enjoying it. I'm glad I gave it a chance. It's the kind of game that I like, and it's the specific kind of experience that I was looking for. So in that sense, it's been all right. But all told, I am still very much looking forward to Hades 2 being a real game, so I can go and play that.
Yes, I'm right there with you. I mean, so I played some Sworn as well, like, last week. And, oh man, it's making me want to play Hades 2 so bad.
So that's Whisker Squadron Survivor. That's what we've been up to lately. And we're now going to move on to our gaming opinion on Old School Funware Goof. We're going to be talking about Bushido Blade. So I have been needling Caitlin to tell me more about her history with fighting games. because I can go down the fighting games rabbit hole all day long and talk about various titles, but I would very much like to focus on things where she's got some experience with it too. She said, oh, I used to play some Bushido Blade. I love me some Bushido Blade. So, Caitlin, why don't you tell us all about it?
Okay. Bushido Blade was one of my favorite fighting games in high school, and I feel it's a little tricky to call it a fighting game in some ways, because it certainly looks like a fighting game, but they changed up some of those core fighting game mechanics. Like, there's no health bars, and there's one-shot kills. If you get a good hit, and granted, I will say, I think it's sometimes difficult to know if you're going to get a good hit on somebody. Maybe there's people who have played this, you know, Bushido Blade a lot more than me, who know when they're going to make a fatal hit. I certainly don't. Or a lethal hit. The whole thing is there's this like big, it's not one open map, but you get to move from stage to stage at will. So if you don't leave the first area, you can fight the first four or five encounters in Bushido Blade all in that very first area. Or you can, you know, take a run and go check out the little bamboo forest. That was my favorite level, by the way. I loved the bamboo forest. I just thought it was the coolest thing when I slash my sword and some of the bamboo trees, like actually, or stalks, I don't know. They're probably not called trees, but some of the bamboo just falls over because you cut it down. Like, coolest thing ever.
Everyone loves that bamboo forest. It's kind of a shame that the game starts you in this ugly ravine type area. And yes, you can just be stuck there for a few stages if you don't know. Like, Bushido Blade is very good at hiding a lot of what's going on.
Yes.
So, like, for example, one of the things that's iconoclastic about Bushido Blade, in addition to having no timer, no life bars, one-hit kills, semi-open world, by the standards of PlayStation 1, I would say that this is fully open world. About as open world as PlayStation 1 can manage.
That's true.
And at the start of every fight, your opponent is going to spend maybe a second or two, not super long, but long enough, like introducing themselves or bowing or threatening you or whatever. Oh, you can just gank them. They are totally vulnerable. You can murder them, but then the game is going to tell you that you haven't been honorable and you're going to get a hard game over. And it's like, what? This is, what? All right. And the ability to move to different stages and all those other things. Like, there's no move lists anywhere. There's no tutorials. There's no nothing. Not even the rule book is not very good at explaining what's going on.
No.
A lot of it is the joy of discovery. And it's one of those things where, yeah, you can unlock extra, like one or two extra things, but you have to do it when it's rainy on Tuesday and never hit anyone's left femur except when their back is turned, et cetera, et cetera. One of those kinds of deals.
Yeah, I got to that game over screen twice before I was like, what am I doing wrong? I can't remember what I'm doing wrong. And then, you know, I Googled it. I was like, oh, I'm not fighting honorably, and therefore I'm just not allowed to see the rest of the game.
More or less.
I thought that was really cool. And of course, I don't remember if it's this way for every character, but the next fight after the one that, you know, if you were dishonorable, you get the game over screen, you're literally bringing a sword to a gunfight.
Yeah.
That guy sucks so much. He made me mad.
Oh, he's terrible. It is an awful, awful boss fight. And you'll hear that voice clip of his over and over and over again.
So many times.
Look, I will maintain, this actually is a good segue, because I was trained as an ethicist. I went to university to study philosophy in both undergrad and grad school. And I have very, very little enthusiasm for honor-based systems, because they tend to be morally arbitrary and sometimes even contemptible. Like, yeah, you can chop someone's head off. That's honorable. But poison, oh, that's for women. And we know that women are dishonorable. It's like, oh, come on, shut up. And, you know, all these other things. Like, some people are beneath honorable contempt. Like, there was this practice of testing out a sword on passing peasants. And this was okay, because they're peasants. They don't have honor, so whatever. Anyway, I don't have much time for that. I have a story from undergrad, though. And this, I think, was 2003. So about 6 or 7 years after Bushido Blade was released. And I was in a class, an intermediate class about Aristotle. I don't really have a lot of enthusiasm for Aristotle as far as philosophers go, particularly about his ethics. Aristotle, just as a to complete this discussion, Aristotle was of the opinion that women had a different number of teeth when compared to men. But this was before the scientific method, so people didn't really think of experimentation or things like that. Other false beliefs that Aristotle had were perfectly understandable, like he thought that heavier objects fell faster than light objects through air, but that was a common misconception, and at least makes intuitive sense, for what it's worth. Anyway, setting all that aside. I was in a class with Professor Delaurier, and there are two things you need to know about Professor Delaurier. One is that she was an Aristotle scholar, and she very much believed in a lot of elements of Aristotelian philosophy, not so much his views on women, though. And number two is that Professor Delaurier petrified me in a way that I think no other teacher had since, like, grade school.
Okay.
She was very intimidating. Anyway, as an exercise for the class, she had us all write down what we had done the previous week. A couple of things that we had done, and she was going to roll this into some discussion about how she thought that Aristotle's views about the good life were fundamentally correct.
Okay.
I had written that I had played Bushido Blade, a timeless video game classic, because I had. And the great thing about Bushido Blade is that playing two players is the way to go. Honestly, like, you can play the story mode, it's whatever, but very much like a lot of other fighters, it's really at its best when playing two-player because you can just have these five-minute-long matches where you're just posturing with a match could be over in 2 seconds, or it could last 20 minutes.
Yeah.
It's wild. And if you're in the mood to make the match really draw out, where you're, like, just slowly maneuvering, very slow sidestep, shift the stance a couple times, reposition, shift stance, reposition back to where you started, it all feels great.
Yeah.
Right? The CPU doesn't let you get away with stuff like that. The CPU is just going to come right at you, so the matches are going to be very quick. Fine, whatever. So I'd written that I'd played Bushido Blade, a timeless video game classic. She sicked timeless. She put sick, you know, open brackets, S-I-C, close brackets, which is to say she basically negged my comment. And I confronted her on it afterwards. I'm like, look, I know these are supposed to be anonymous, but I'm the one who wrote about this. First of all, you misspelled, she rendered it as Bushida. Which, whatever, my handwriting was terrible, so she just misread it. But maybe she doesn't know what Bushido is, that's fine.
Yeah.
I said, why'd you sick it? It's like, well, it's based on technology, so I don't think it can be timeless. And I said, that's ridiculous. Would you say the same thing about a work of literature? Because writing is a technology, publication's a technology, and arguably language is also a technology. Would you say the same thing about those things? Would you say that Aristotle can't be timeless because his publications are necessarily premised on a series of technological advancements? She paused for a moment and then she retracted her position. And she was willing to acknowledge that a video game could theoretically be timeless.
All right.
Anyway, that's my story about Bushido Blade.
That's funny, man. Like, it is. I mean, in some ways, like, yeah, I don't know. I'm glad that you got her to question her position.
She was very intellectually rigorous.
Yeah.
And very willing to admit that when she'd been wrong. But it took a lot of my courage to do so. The next time I had to interact with Professor Delaurier, I had to disagree with her in the middle of a paper presentation, and that petrified me almost as much as a couple of months later when she was the one who was evaluating my teaching of a section.
Oh, God.
I'll never forget that day. I was so frightened. It turned out all right. But back to Bushido Blade. It's kind of a good news, bad news situation. The good news is that emulating the PlayStation is very easy. Almost anything can emulate the PlayStation. The bad news is there hasn't been a modern remaster.
Yeah.
Or just a modern re-release. And, as I said, it's best with two-player, and Fightcade, I don't know if you're familiar with Fightcade, Caitlin.
I'm not, no.
Fightcade is an online program that allows you to play emulated games, primarily but not exclusively fighting games, online with rollback netcode.
Oh, okay.
But it's based on the Final Burn Neo emulator, which is a fabulous arcade emulator. And you can do all kinds of amazing fighting games, but not PlayStation titles. So aww. If it was a PlayStation original, Fightcade won't work. And so to the best of my understanding, there's no easy way to play Bushido Blade online with other people. It's one of those PlayStation series that is just relegated to relative obscurity. So I would put this in the same category as Tobal. Tobal was, I think Tobal's a pretty good fighting game. Bloody Roar 2, which is an excellent fighting game, only on the PlayStation, can't get it anywhere else. And Bushido Blade. So, it's a shame.
Yeah, that is a shame. Like, I remember I would spend hours with my twin sister and my friends just running around. And, you know, just, it was so much fun to play in versus mode. And unfortunately, I didn't have the opportunity to play against another person, you know, in this last week. That would have been great.
I don't have anyone local to play fighting games with, and it's just a shame. Do you have any thoughts on the sequel, Bushido Blade 2?
I remember enjoying it, probably just because it was more Bushido Blade, but I can't remember a whole lot about it. I do have the disc in my house. I was planning to, you know, try it at some point and just try to remember. I remember it looking a little better graphically. Was that also on the PlayStation or was that PS2?
No, Bushido Blade 2 was on the PlayStation.
Also PlayStation. The first PlayStation. Okay.
It's a little weird. I mean, it suffers because one of the reasons why Bushido Blade is so enduring is because of how iconoclastic it is. So yeah. Necessarily the second one isn't going to have the same kind of impact. You know, the cast, it does look better. The cast is much, much bigger. Mm-hmm. The weapon selection is different. But I just remember it feeling less original, feeling less...
For sure.
...essential than the first Bushido Blade. And so having much less of an influence. But it's a shame that these ideas were never really developed on. I mean, if anything, the closest analog that I can think of, and this is not a good analog, is something like Nidhogg, if you've played that game.
Oh, so, okay. I bought that hoping that I would get to play it with someone, and I've never played it with anybody, and I still kind of want to.
Nidhogg is weird, but it has some of that same element of visceral positioning and instant death that Bushido Blade does.
Yeah, I think that's what drew me to it originally, but then I just didn't have anyone to play with.
Well, that's Bushido Blade, one of the few fighters that Square put out in the 90s. A beloved PlayStation classic. If you like fighting games and have never played Bushido Blade, I really think you should give it a shot. It will definitely make you question a lot of the conventions that we take for granted because, you know, fundamentally, I'm not going to say that Guilty Gear Strive and Street Fighter 2 are basically the same game. That would be a gross overstatement. But when you start looking at the number of things they have in common, it's quite voluminous.
Yeah.
And it's rather surprising that we don't see more attempts to really bust out of the established formula. All right, let's take a brief break to hear from our sponsors.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And we're back.
So we're going to be moving on to our feature game, Transistor. Transistor is by Supergiant, who, as you may know already, created Hades. And
never heard of it.
Before Hades, also worked on Bastion, Pyre, and of course, Transistor. Yeah, so Transistor it's a neat one. It has all of the same amazing music that Supergiant games always have had. You play the main character, Red, who is basically like a super popular singer in this world. She lives in the city of Cloudbank, and something bad happens at a show at the very beginning, and she ends up with the Transistor. I have a hard time in some ways talking about Transistor because I felt like I loved it so much, first of all. I played this back when it came out originally. I played it a little bit more this last week. It's a beautiful game. I love the voice acting, the narrator slash, you know, the Transistor. I think they also call him Unknown. His voice is amazing, and just how he talks to you, the player, as Red, I think it's all perfect. Like, you can really hear, like, his... He feels like a real character, even though he's, you know, just somebody in a sword. Like, he's concerned about Red, and I don't know. I just love their dynamic, even though Red literally never speaks. But I have a hard time because so much of this story is hard for me to parse. Like, the big hits, I think, are all there, but they're very light on the details. And I think that I've read that if you look into all of the written information in Transistor, if you actually take your time to read everything you see, that more of the details will come out. But that's a tough part for me.
I agree entirely. This is the same school of storytelling that we've seen in games of roughly the same era. So Transistor came out in 2014.
Yes.
And games like Hyper Light Drifter were pulling the same stuff, albeit with different techniques, but the same kind of vibe of, oh, we're not going to really tell you what's going on. We're just going to set a mood and let you fill in the details to a certain extent. And this is the same kind of stuff that the From Software games do in the Soulsborne games. Like, yeah, we're going to establish an aesthetic vibe, but... we're not going to actually spell out the details of what's going on, like some kind of room. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Maybe this just makes me incredibly basic. And in many ways I am. But could you not just spin me a yarn? Like, would it kill you? Like,
yeah.
Is it... Like, I get that there's a certain satisfaction from deciphering incoherent or superficially incoherent knowledge. You know, to a certain extent, I get a certain sense of satisfaction. I've talked about this in the context of, like, the really ASCII-based roguelikes, as opposed to the roguelites, you know, Caves of Cthulhu, or Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup. It's like, once you get to the other side, and you've mastered the interface, you feel like you're in some sort of weird secret club. I get that. I'm not blind to that joy.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to tell you that that's better than having a good interface to start with, or an accessible interface to start with. Maybe you can't make Caves of Cthulhu or Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup with an accessible, seamless, breezy interface. Maybe not. You can definitely tell a story and not be quite as silly. Like, I'm not saying the story has to be blunt or simplistic. Not everything needs to be like Paddington 2. Like, I get that. That's fine.
Yeah.
But by the same token, you can make it so that somebody who's played the game and paid attention knows what happened. Or you can make a conscious decision to make what happened ambiguous.
Yes.
But don't tell me that there's a literal sequence of narrative events that literally happen in the real world, but we're going to be coy about what they are. So you have to go find them. I'm so over that method of storytelling. I am with you 100%.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Did you play Bastion?
I did. I loved Bastion.
You loved Bastion. Okay. So Bastion was released in 2011. It was Supergiant's first game, and it, you know, was a very, very, very super popular indie game. And I heard all manner of people, both in person and online, rave about it. And I really didn't like it. I found it really kind of boring in terms of the gameplay, and people kept raving about the method of the storytelling. And again, I had some of the same objections that we've just articulated to Bastion.
Yeah, that's true.
And I also just didn't really like the dynamic of a silent protagonist and some narrator doing all the work of setting everything up. It didn't feel natural, and it made the overall proceedings feel a bit monotonous. Like, literally, it was just always the same person talking. Like, even people who are reading audiobooks give a little bit of modulation to their voice, right? You can have a strong narrator. I would point to something like Disco Elysium. Disco Elysium has a strong narrator, a brilliant narrator, who sets the tone and has a legitimate editorial voice to the entire proceedings. But at the same time, other people get to speak. And even the narrator has different inflection, and so there's a way to vary it up. And when I play Transistor and when I play Bastion, I get the same vibe. It's just the same person yammering in my ear the entire time, and I just, it feels literally and figuratively monotonous.
Yeah, that's funny.
In the case of Red, I understand. She's, like, there's a reason why she's silent. This isn't like a silent, this isn't my normal objection to silent protagonist, because normally it's just very clumsy and artificial, and it makes them seem like not real people. But this just put further burdens on the narrator. And yes, the execution of the narrator, very, very good execution, very talented voice actor. And the writing is probably pretty good, but it just structurally, I found it unsatisfying.
Yeah, that's so funny. Like, hearing your thoughts on the narrator in general, like in both Bastion and in Transistor, because when I first experience the narrator and Bastion just walking around and having him talk about things that happen or are just about to happen. I was like, oh man, like, this is neat. So I was really overtaken by, I don't know, it was new to me, I guess.
Yeah, I wasn't blind to the novelty. I just felt that it was kind of like a gimmick that couldn't sustain itself for the entire duration of the playtime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sustained itself for me, but I can understand the complaint.
So this was my first experience with Transistor. I've always been meaning to go back to it. And the moment that I started getting into the rhythm of the game, like 10 minutes in, I'm like, oh yeah, this is Supergiant pre-Pyre. Like, Bastion and Transistor, they're very different games, and they are very different tones in terms of the worlds and the stories they're telling. But the storytelling idiom and the overall storytelling structure is exactly the same.
Absolutely.
And so I got very strong flashbacks. Pyre was the first Supergiant game that I enjoyed. I didn't finish it because I felt it was a little bit long in the tooth the way a lot of visual novels are. And there's a certain amount of text. There's only a certain amount of text that I'm willing to read on a screen. But the overall structure I thought was kind of cool. And it was probably my favorite game of sports ball that I've ever played.
Yeah. Pyre impressed me. That was a really interesting game.
It let other characters speak, both figuratively and literally, right?
That's true, yeah.
And so, like, it's a huge difference. When you compare Pyre and Hades, I'm not saying that Pyre and Hades are very similar, but I think that Pyre and Hades are clearly on the other side of a divide from Bastion and Transistor. Bastion and Transistor sound and feel so similar to each other, and Pyre and Hades don't. Like, there's a certain vibe, you're right, the music sounds the same. There's a certain kind of vocal performance that all the games are consistent throughout in Supergiant. So, like, there's absolutely a through line you can pull from all their four published games. Hades 2 doesn't count yet. Talk to Moon, it's a real game. It just doesn't really work for me in the early works. And I realize I'm a bit alone, and some of that is just very particular preferences that I have. But part of it is also just like, look, if you're going to tell me a story, you know, tell me the story. Don't play hide and seek with me or something.
No, you make a really good point, because when you first started talking about Bastion, I was like, oh yeah, Bastion actually had... I had exactly the same complaints about Bastion, feeling like I didn't fully know what was going on. And it bugs me. I don't know. I think I just don't necessarily like that kind of very subtle storytelling, where I genuinely thought the world was cool. And I wanted to learn more, and I didn't know how to do that. And nowadays, like, I could just, you know, you could just go on Reddit or Wikipedia or whatever and read it there. But, like, I shouldn't have to do that, right?
Yeah. And it actually just occurs to me, Bastion is actually closer to the Soulsborne games in a lot other ways, because it's about navigating this dead and dying world that is kind of abandoned and defunct. It's more about the vibe than specific story beats. Mm-hmm. Which, again, is a legitimate approach to storytelling. It's just not one that I prefer.
Yeah.
So, you wanted to talk about the combat.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on the combat of Transistor?
So, I thought it was cool. I liked that you could, like, build out kind of what you want to do, because you can, you know, slot certain functions as passives or as, you know, kind of add-ons to other skills. But it doesn't feel designed for the kind of person I am, which is very impatient. So the number of times I would try to just do a fight without doing the whole plan out thing, and it doesn't go well because the game, like, Transistor is not designed for that to go well. But I would try it anyway because it's like, oh, I don't want to pause it and then have to plan out my moves.
So it's trying to be this hybrid of real-time and turn-based combat. And to a large extent, I don't think that the hybridization works as well as it could have. It's functional, and it gets the job done. But I think that the seams start to show the more you poke at either of the two elements, either the real-time or the turn-based. I agree with you about the functions. The different combat functions that you acquire can be used as either an active, a passive, or as a modifier to an active skill. And you're encouraged to experiment with them, because every time you use them in a new way in combat, you get a new bit of lore attached to the characters. And I think that was fabulous. And playing around with the different functions and seeing them do different things was super awesome and really encourages experimentation and improvisation. And I really love it when games of this ilk encourage you not to rely on the same three techniques the entire game. And yeah. they're all satisfying in various ways. Even the ones that I didn't enjoy using, even the ones that didn't merge with my specific playstyle, I thought were neat and I could see how they were useful. I didn't see a dud in the bunch.
Yeah.
And that is really, really well done. The functions were great, how they were implemented were great, how they interacted with the narrative was great. The more you poke at the real-time versus turn-based stuff, though, I felt that it was, in the context of the turn-based element, it felt kind of sloppy, and in the real-time element, it felt kind of sluggish.
Mm-hmm.
At any time, you can pause the game and queue up a whole bunch of commands and then have them execute almost instantaneously. I had two primary beefs with the turn-based element. Number one, it cared a whole lot about the pathing, and there's no grid, except there's kind of a grid. It's kind of a subtle implied grid that I never really got the hang of. If there is a grid, it's too fine-grained for me to quite understand what was going on. I think they could have had a much more coarse grid like Persona 5 Tactica has. Persona 5 Tactica gives you the illusion of free movement, but you're still moving on a grid, and as a consequence, you do get that fluidity, and at the same time, you always know where things are going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I frequently found myself in a position in Transistor of trying to use my melee attack and the game telling me, no, you're not in range. I'm like, I'm not?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's like, no,
okay.
I totally am.
Undo the melee attack, undo the move, try to move again. It's just awkward and kind of unpredictable.
Yeah, that could definitely be clunky.
The worst part, though, was I would be there in the pause of plotting out my moves, and it would tell me that I was going to do 4 backstabs in a row. And I was planning on doing that damage. It shows me how much damage I'm going to do. And then I tell the sequence to run. And then just because it's being executed almost in real time, not at full speed, just a little bit of speed, halfway through my attack string, the enemy has slowly turned around. And so the third and fourth attacks that I queued up don't do backstab damage. And there was no way for me to know that this was going to be the case when I loaded it in. Now, just to be clear, some enemies, the moment they take a hit, teleport away to safety.
Yeah.
Or activate a shield, or do something. That's fine. That's predictable. I can know what's going to happen. But don't tell me that it's going to do a certain amount of damage, and that it's going to have a certain effect, because I've loaded it in the turn-based interface, and then have the real-time element, which is completely impossible to parse at the outset, tell me that I'm going to do a different amount of damage or I have a different set of effects. I found that routinely frustrating.
Yeah, having the enemy just turn around and be like, I guess I'm not getting backstabbed anymore. What you going to do about it? Like, yeah, that's painful.
If sometimes it would work. Sometimes I get the 4 backstabs.
Yeah.
Sometimes I get 1. Sometimes I get 3. Who knows? And in an action game, that's fine. You know, if I'm playing Doom, it's okay that I don't know exactly when the imp is going to turn around and start blasting me in the face, because I can react. But if I load it in the turn-based sequence where everything is paused, and especially, again, they tell you how much, they start giving you numbers and stats, I'm sorry, don't then start playing fast and loose with that when the quote-unquote real-time element comes in. Because during the real-time element, you can't really do much.
Yeah.
It's very sluggish. All you can basically do is just try to run to cover and hope that you don't get damaged too much, because you can't do anything else. Your abilities are all on cooldown. There's no ability to dodge the incoming fire. It's just you're vulnerable and you're sitting there waiting.
Yeah, so, I mean, you can use, there's one thing you can use, right? Jaunt, is it?
Well, there's one ability that, as an active ability, allows you to use it while things are on cooldown. There's also attached as a modifier to another function, allows that function to be used when everything else is on cooldown. For a while, again, talking about how great the functions are, I experimented with a build that had the stealth function have that modifier. And so what I would routinely do was queue up all my attacks, and then once the cooldown started, I would then go into stealth and then run to safety.
Okay, that's nice. That's smart.
It was fun. I mean, it had limitations because then the stealth ability would have its own separate cooldown, independent from the action bar that takes a while to refill. It would just be on a hard 10-second cooldown.
Yeah.
So I couldn't pull that trick all the time. But it was neat. And again, it was fun to play around with. It's just, I felt that, I sincerely felt that this sort of real-time turn-based hybrid was them seeing if they could pull it off rather than being genuinely motivated by some kind of vision about how the combat should feel.
Yeah, I mean, the real-time portions felt more like in-between, you know, this is just in-between all the times when you get to do something cool, you just, you know, try not to die, sorry. It didn't feel as intentional, I guess, as I would have expected it to.
Yeah, I think the combat system, with only very minor modifications in Transistor, could have been made either fully real-time or fully turn-based. Or heck, I mean, maybe even have, if you really wanted to try to bite off a lot, have different combat sequences work in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
Have some that are real-time and have some that are turn-based. I don't know. But as it is, the way these two parts meshed with each other felt anything but seamless. And I did not appreciate the interplay that was going on. I felt that the function system was so good it deserved better, frankly.
Yeah, no, I can agree with that. I mean, just, I didn't play too much. I got through, I resumed my New Game Plus that I had started, you know, 10 years ago or whatever. I was right at the beginning. And I went through, you know, I fought the first boss. I fought those really annoying little egg-throwing robots. But the number of times that I would go into my turn, you know, the turn-based mode and try to do stuff and then have to undo everything, exit out of turn-based mode, move a little bit, and then do it again. It was rough.
I absolutely agree that Transistor is overflowing with style.
Mm-hmm.
The world that it's got, you know, the mood, which is informed by the visual design, by the architecture, by the plot beats even, by the characterizations, the wardrobe that the wardrobes that people have. It's this sort of near future dystopian art deco kind of noir, and it's really, really good looking.
Yeah.
And really helps to sell the mood, which again makes me wish that more storytelling that it had used slightly more conventional storytelling elements, because the mood was already so well established by the rest of the world. They didn't also need this incredibly restricted storytelling method, but that's me kind of beating a dead horse. Also maybe a little bit disappointed by the fact that the enemies are so boring. It's just a bunch of robots.
Mm-hmm.
And not a huge variety of them either. Like, the boss fights are great. The bosses look cool and act in interesting ways. But a lot of the other combat encounters I felt were just, like, padding.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I'm going to out myself as a fake gamer. But that's how I feel about so many games. I mean, that was my main complaint about BioShock Infinite. It's like, why do you give me this game that I think is so cool in so many ways, but then you just pad it out with all these ridiculously long murder fests that I just don't care for at all.
Oh, I agree. I agree. BioShock Infinite is, I don't understand why everyone loves that game so much. Because again, it's got this great world, right? It's got this wonderfully informed world with, again, everything, the costumes, the architecture, the music, it's all working together. And they just don't seem to want to use it properly in a lot of ways. I also have very serious problems with the presentation of the villain and his descent into racist evil.
Yeah.
But that's a separate issue, and we'd have to get into spoilers. But yeah, like it's like these people have this toolkit, this sandbox, and then they don't know what to do with it. Not to say that it should be a sandbox style game.
Yeah.
But it's just not playing to its strengths. And it makes it seem like a bit of a wasted opportunity. Again, unlike some of the later things, I feel like in Pyre and in Hades especially, Supergiant was really hitting their stride and everything is informing everything else.
Yeah, in Transistor, I felt there were so many just small little flavor moments of the game when you're exploring and you learn something about the city or about, you know, this person that died or whatever. It's like, if you could have just replaced a few more of the combat sequences with a few more of these things to just tell a story, even if it's not like, it doesn't have to be plot relevant necessarily, but just something to add even more flavor to the world, I would have been perfectly happy. Like, those were some of my favorite parts of Transistor.
One last set of questions, though, and this is because, again, this may be the part where I'm revealed to be the fake gamer and the person unable to appreciate storytelling, or maybe we're on the same page.
Okay.
As I've said before on the show, and anyone who knows my media preferences knows that I'm a sucker for a good love story, and I'm a sucker for a bad love story, I'm a sucker for a mediocre love story, I'm a sucker for a formulaic love story. This one didn't really work for me. And I felt like I was just being told that there was this kind of relationship between this silent woman and this talking sword, rather than really getting the impression that this was some sort of, that they were tragically being separated by circumstances of, you know, again, sword.
Yeah.
What did you think?
So it's a little tough, you know, having played through the whole game many years ago and then playing just part of it more recently. But so I was on board just because, you know, I love love stories. I think they're great. I agree definitely to some point about there being like, you know, we're just kind of being told, like, we didn't get any opportunity whatsoever to know this character before he became a sword. And we don't even get to see Red's reaction to him having been stabbed with a giant sword and murdered. And yeah. Now, you know, his body is a sword and she just drags him around. Like, that part's a little tough for me. I think, but there was also, you know, the little bit of flavor. There was one, like, you can order food, and if you go to Red's apartment, you'll have a little scene of her eating whatever food you ordered. And, like, there was some conversations with unknown at that point that I thought were kind of cool. But I would have liked to have to see a little bit more of their history rather than just, you know, the terrible crap that they're going through right now.
Again, it's like they're prisoners of their creative decisions. By this, I mean Supergiant, not Red and Unknown, right? They've decided to start in medias res. We don't really know too much about their backstories. One of them cannot speak, and one of them doesn't have a face. And so...
Yes.
We're not left with a whole bunch. I felt, for what it's worth, the same way. Just to make clear to everyone that I'm way out of left field, I feel the same way about the famous anime film Your Name. Like, we're told that the two characters have fallen in love. I never saw it, right? Like, if two characters on screen smile at each other the right way, I could be like, I will die to protect their love. But sometimes a movie is like, this is a great love story. I'm like, So maybe I'm just missing something. I don't know. Reading and hearing about some people's reaction to Transistor reminded me about hearing people talk about Your Name. To a certain extent.
Okay. Yeah. So I also loved Your Name.
And I
I was also on board for that love story.
Okay. Well, look, just to be clear, that scene where he writes on her hand, I was bawling, right? Like, I was totally hook, line, and sinker. But the thing is that I, at the same time, I was like, when exactly did this happen? Like, sure. Okay, I get it. They're super in love. Fine. I'm there. I'm into it. But I didn't really see that happen. Anyway, I love that. I love bits of that movie. The bit where she's figuring out what pronouns to use, that scene where he writes in her hand, like, perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. And I love Makoto Shinkai. I love his movies. But I just couldn't, the main relationship, I kind of missed it being established. And I've seen that movie like 3 times trying to figure it out. It's like an archaeologist uncovering ancient secrets. Like, what is everyone else seeing? It makes me feel like I'm a sociopath. Or something.
Oh.
But like, what is everyone else seeing that I'm not seeing?
Yeah.
It's so... Anyway, it's messing with my head.
I'm sorry.
I should watch that movie a fourth time just to see. Anyway.
Clearly. Maybe this time it'll do it.
Maybe this time it'll do it. Anyway, so that's Transistor. And a deep dive into my psyche and my views on romance. So, Caitlin, let us engage in some shameless hyping of upcoming titles. What would you like to shout out?
Today, I'm going to shout out the Tsukuden 1 and 2 HD remaster.
Oh!
I just found out about it like 2 days ago. I'm super excited because I absolutely loved both of those games to death. It will be released March 6th, which I forget exactly schedule-wise. It might be released by the time this airs, but I'm 100% going to buy it. So yeah, I'm super jazzed for that.
I remember when Tsukuden 2 was impossible to find. It was one of those legendarily difficult to acquire games. And people would talk about, oh yeah, it's worth getting it. Like,
Yeah, but I can't buy it for $400 at GameStop or whatever, right? Like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Wow, we sound so old.
Yeah, I know.
You don't buy games at GameStop. You buy a Funko Pop and you buy and sell their stock as part of a global conspiracy theory. Yes. That's what GameStop is for, Caitlin.
My mistake.
Get with it, no cap. Anyway, I would like to shout out yet another handheld gizmo. The last handheld gizmo that I shouted out that I've actually acquired was the Retroid Pocket 5, which was interesting, but I ended up selling it actually at a profit because I was able to sell it off when stocks were low. I didn't really like the ergonomics. Didn't really fit in my hands the way that I wanted it to. But I've made reasonably clear on this show that when it comes to handheld devices, I am all about the clamshell.
Mm-hmm.
Once you go clamshell, you never go back shell. And there is going to be a clamshell version of the Retroid Pocket 5 called the Retroid Pocket Flip 2. The Retroid Pocket Flip 1 was amazing. I have it right here on my shelf. I have it in the limited edition Race Red version. I absolutely loved it, with its little sliders and everything. But this one is going to have a much better processor, a 5.5-inch screen with OLED. I'm not huge into OLED, but I'm not blind to its benefits. And I am super looking forward to it because clamshells are the way to go in all cases. And I very much prefer the ergonomics, generally speaking, of those things. And so I'm looking forward to that.
Sounds amazing.
Clamshells, Caitlin.
Clamshells. Clamshells. That's going to do it for this episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. I hope you all have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next time. Thanks, everyone.
Goodbye. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply. For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.